Nuclear gaslighting. The last thing the nuclear power brokers want to see is a solid, growing grassroots movement against their technology's many assaults on the health of people and the environment. They claim that they always operate in our own best interests, and they've got the government data to prove it. So as amateurs, concerned community members who don't necessarily have PhDs in physics, we'd best leave all the decisions to those who are in the nuclear know and trust them. But then, a major investigative report comes out from an internationally respected news agency which cast new light on the government's reports. And you hear from a woman who has been a steadfast activist for total cleanup of her neighborhood's radioactive contaminated site, and she tells you,
they looked at the report and saw that it included data that even at the time in 2016 that the report was written, some of this data was 20 years old. Some of it was 30 years old. I mean, it was obsolete. And the conclusion they came to, which was exactly how we felt when we left that meeting in 2016, was that the agency and the government very much wanted to be able to just shut us the heck up and get the groundswell and the activism and the support that was growing in our community. They wanted to throw a very heavy blanket on that and snuff it out.
Well, when Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL tells you what this shocking in-depth report from Reuters news agency says, what it means, and how it verifies all of the objections raised against the government's reports for more than a decade, you see how insidiously a community can be forced to live up close and personal with that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, the investigative report that is sending shockwaves through the nuclear world and the government agencies we trust to protect us. We talk with Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL about the impact of a recent report from Reuters news agency that was 2 years in the making and reveals ineptitude and downright lying in government reports meant to assure residents living near the radiologically contaminated Bridgeton landfill in North St. Louis that there was nothing to worry about. Talk about governmental gaslighting. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. The Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter. Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness. And more honest nuclear information than Elon Musk and Donald Trump said during their one-hour talk on X, formerly known as Twitter. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 13, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., the push to reopen Michigan's Palisades nuclear plant, which was shut down in May 2022 and scheduled for decommissioning, has hit a snag because a whistleblower has stepped forward with safety concerns about reopening the 53-year-old power plant. Alan Blind, a former engineering director who served for 7 years at the plant, cast doubt on Holtex, the owner of the property, their proposed budget and timeline for restoring Palisades, given that no U.S. reactor has ever come back online after ceasing operations ahead of a planned demolition. New laws that Congress passed over the past 3 years have made billions of dollars available to the nuclear energy industry to extend the operating lives of existing plants, build new reactors, and catch up with Russia and China on what they call next-generation nuclear power technologies. In March of this year, the Department of Energy offered Holtec a loan worth $1.5 billion to make Palisades the first U.S. nuclear plant to ever come back online after shutting down in preparation for decommissioning. On Monday, Reuters cited Blind, saying that Palisades plant received waivers from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission that exempted the facility from modern safety standards that prevent insulation on pipes from breaking down and clogging cooling systems, guard against earthquakes, and curb risks from fires. As for the feasibility of Palisades restart, Blind said, "There's just so many questions about this whole thing that the probability of success has to be considered very low." In Arizona, a lot has happened in the last week at Canyon Mine, renamed Pinyon Plain Mine, a controversial uranium mine south of the Grand Canyon. On July 30th, two trucks hauling uranium ore quietly left the mine, heading for the White Mesa Uranium Mill about 300 miles away in Utah. The mine's owner, Energy Fuel Resources, had promised to provide 2 weeks' advance notice to Native Nations before hauling began, but that did not happen. Navajo Nation, which bans uranium transport on its lands, immediately deployed Navajo police to stop them, but the trucks snuck through. The Havasupai tribe issued a strong statement condemning Energy Fuels Resources for attacking tribal sovereignty and putting the health and safety of Havasupai and Navajo tribal members and citizens of Arizona at risk. On August 2nd, Navajo Nation First Lady Jasmine Blackwater Nygren held a rally in Cameron, followed by a march along the haul route. That same day, Arizona Governor Kathy Hobbs announced the uranium company would pause its trucks in hope of reaching a deal with Navajo Nation. Energy Fuels has said it plans to send 6 to 8 trucks a day from the mine to the White Mesa Mill. Protests continued throughout the weekend, calling for the closure of the mine. In New Mexico, Los Alamos National Laboratory plans to vent radioactive tritium into the northern New Mexico's mountain air. Tritium is an element that is 150,000 times more radioactive than plutonium, and according to Arjun Makhjani, an expert on nuclear fission and author of the book Exploring Tritium's Dangers, is enough to contaminate 100 billion gallons of water in the United States drinking water up to the allowable limit. Japan has been releasing tritium-contaminated radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima. Their releases will take place over 3 decades, while Los Alamos National Laboratory's venting would include up to 3 times more tritium and take place in a matter of days. Here with an overview of a wide range of nuclear folly is Linda Pence-Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
Sometimes, well, actually most of the time, it can be very hard to get any oxygen for our issue. And then along comes a presidential election year and an Olympics year to boot, and the challenge ramps up even more. Is there any possibility that somewhere out there is a group called Childless Cat Ladies against nuclear power? No chance. Could we brag about our crowd size at our latest anti-nuclear protest? Best not. Is there anything we can say about couches? No nuclear angle there. Any gold medal winning performances in changing the minds of members of Congress and getting them to swear off the nuclear Kool-Aid? We're still running that marathon, but it's not looking good. But it's not as if serious and important things aren't happening. There's still a war in Ukraine, and the 15 reactors there are still in danger, especially the 6 at Zaporizhia, closest to the most intense of the fighting. A fire at one of the 2 cooling towers on the site drew headlines over the weekend, with both Russia and Ukraine blaming each other for starting it. As Arjun Makhijani wrote in Just Solutions, the site contains more highly radioactive cesium-137 than was released in more than 400 atmospheric nuclear tests conducted by all nuclear states put together. A release of roughly 1% of this inventory would be comparable to the 1986 Chernobyl disaster. Now there is also news suggesting that Ukrainian forces are making incursions into Russia and approaching the Kursk nuclear power plant, one of the 3 biggest in Russia. We continue to believe, or maybe at this point, more than 2 years into this war, desperately hope that neither side would be reckless enough to attack a nuclear power plant. The consequences would benefit no one. We can also sense growing alarm over developments in the Middle East, where nuclear weapon power Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah are threatening a wider war beyond the horrific bombing of Gaza. Iran does not have nuclear weapons, but could get them in a blink of an eye, as the country is already enriching its uranium supply well beyond reactor grade level to at least 65% and likely higher. That's already considered nuclear weapons usable. Above 90% is weapons grade. Meanwhile, here at home, the state of Nebraska, bursting with wind power potential, announced the names of 16 communities chosen by the Nebraska Public Power District as potential homes for new nuclear power plants. Did anyone ask the residents of those cities if they'd like a nuke in their backyard? Did the Public Power District even attempt to educate people about the risks or the waste? I'm guessing not. Maybe Nebraskans would like to take a look at the NuScale Squad, a team of 50 members under the acronym UAMPS, vying to have small modular reactors in their backyard. The whole project collapsed and sent NuScale stocks plunging. It was an even bigger fiasco than the Olympic fortunes of the US men's 4x100 meters relay final. Let's hope our guys get that baton passing business down in time for the 2028 Games in Los Angeles. By then, more nuclear batons will have been fumbled and dropped, climate change will likely be worse, and there still won't be any new small modular reactors. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
A powerful earthquake struck off southern Japan on Thursday, August 8th, causing mostly minor injuries, but raising the level of concern over possible major quakes stemming from the undersea Nankai Trough east of the coast. There are two nuclear power stations around the quake-hit area, Sensai in Kagoshima Prefecture and Ikata nuclear power plants in Aihami Prefecture. No damage to either nuclear power site has yet been reported. There's nothing like a demonstration for peace that kicks off a diplomatic war. For last week's commemoration of the dropping of the atomic bomb by the United States on Nagasaki, the Nagasaki Municipal Government, which hosts the city's annual peace ceremony, said it did not extend an invitation to the Israeli ambassador due to security concerns. In response, the ambassadors from the United States and the United Kingdom also refused to attend Nagasaki's ceremony. Instead, the ambassadors from the US, UK, and Israel paid their respects about 1,200 kilometers away at a Tokyo temple. All three envoys had attended Tuesday's ceremony in Hiroshima. In terms of protests, Nagasaki's anti-nuclear sit-in campaign has surpassed its 500th rally as aging survivors of the atomic bomb and younger generations renew their commitment to abolishing nuclear weapons. Held monthly at Nagasaki Peace Park, except during August when the Peace Memorial Ceremony takes place, the sit-ins have become a symbol of unwavering determination. At the 501st sit-in on July 9, Koichi Kawano, 84 years old and a survivor of the Nagasaki bombing, emphasized the importance of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, calling Japan's failure to join the treaty a national disgrace for the world's only wartime atomic-bombed nation. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Japan is in the middle of releasing its eighth batch of tritium-contaminated radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. But that doesn't mean it stopped flogging sales of its seafood to the rest of the world. Oh, sure, China and Russia have banned sales of all Japanese marine products because of radiation risks. They are such party poopers. And sales have plummeted, which only means that it's a perfect time to foist the harvest on unsuspecting Americans. After all, while Japan bans the sale of any food with a reading of 100 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram, the U.S. has the highest so-called limit in the world, 1,200 becquerels of cesium per kilogram. It's perfectly legal to sell American seafood that is 12 times too radioactively contaminated to be sold in Japan. So naturally, That makes us prime targets for the sale of the seafood, most recently and specifically, scallops. And by using processing centers in Mexico, which result in what's termed a better quality of radioactive scallop, Japanese sales are targeting U.S. high-end supermarkets and sushi restaurants. So if you're interested in slurping down raw scallops seasoned with just a soupçon of Fukushima's radioactive cesium, feel free to chow down on them at the sushi palace of your choice, especially here in Los Angeles, and especially on the Beverly Hills, Brentwood, West Side. As for me, I haven't eaten sushi since before Fukushima, but hey, whatever floats your boat. And that's why, if you're still planning on eating raw scallops in the Japanese restaurant of your choice, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat Num Nuts of the Week.
Internationally, in the war in Ukraine, as Ukrainian forces were closing in on the Kursk 6-unit nuclear facility in Russia, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky said in a telegram force that Russian forces had started a fire in the Russian-controlled Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in southern Ukraine. Zelensky posted a video showing a large plume of black smoke coming out of one of the towers on the plant. He said radiation indicators were normal, but blamed Russia for using the nuclear plant, quote, to blackmail Ukraine and all of Europe and the world. Yevhen Yevchenko, head of the Ukrainian-controlled military administration, which looks out onto the plant, called it a provocation or an attempt to create panic, and reassured that Zaporizhia is, quote, operating as normal as possible under the conditions of occupation. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, when I was a kid, there were times I wanted to go outside and play with some new toy, but my mom would always ask, "Have you cleaned up the mess in your room?" The answer was invariably no, and then she'd say, "If you don't clean up your mess, you can't go out to play." Ouch! Accountability and immediate incentive to clean things up, which I did. That kind of accountability doesn't seem to exist between our government and the nuclear industry. They make a mess, collect fees, denigrate anyone or any group that dares to tell them they have a responsibility to us, and the government agencies tasked with protecting us agree and let them get away with it. Whatever the radiological mess, the nukesters delay, deny, refuse to clean it up, all the while lobbying Congress for the right to make even more of the mess. But sometimes they get called on it, as you will hear in today's featured interview. And learning about the tactics and effective ways to fight back against them, that's what Nuclear Hot Seat is all about. We're dedicated to giving you the nuclear stories you cannot find in mainstream media, providing them with context and continuity so you can understand exactly what we're up against and what you can do about it. To continue this work, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations. And without community support, we won't be able to keep going. And we make it easy for you to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. There, you can help us with a donation of any size, and you can also set up a recurring monthly donation for as little as $5 a month, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. So if you value in-depth information on nuclear issues from that all-important different perspective, please, help us keep doing it. Right now, go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. There's a famous definition of journalism, that it's supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. That's exactly what an August 7, 2024 report from Reuters news agency did. To quote the lead, companies and others responsible for some of America's most toxic waste sites are using a federal health agency's faulty reports to save money on cleanups, defend against lawsuits, and deny victims compensation. That was the result of a 2-year investigation by Reuters. Specifically, it honed in on how the Environmental Protection Agency and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, or ATSDR, presented reports riddled with distorted, obsolete data to, quote-unquote, prove that there was nothing to worry about from the smoldering radiological Bridgeton waste dump in North St. Louis, Missouri. To find out about the impact of this report and what it means to that community that's been fighting for cleanup, I spoke with Dawn Chapman. She's co-founder of the group Just Moms STL and a leading spokesperson for the concerns of the neighborhood and the larger implications of the Reuters report. We spoke on Sunday, August 11, 2024. Dawn Chapman, as always, it's great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me again, Levy.
This is about a powerful report that was issued last week by Reuters, the news agency. And it's the result of an investigation that took them around 2 years to put together. And it's specific to Westlake Landfill and the situation you have been dealing with there. First of all, what was the report about and how aware were you that this was something that was in the process of being pulled together?
Karen and I were approached by Reuters and their executives and a team of investigators that they hired a little over 2 years ago. And they wanted to look at the reports from the Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry that was done at Westlake that said, oh, nothing to see here, folks. Everything's fine. It's cool. It's fine that you live next to a radioactive waste illegal dump on fire, that sort of thing. But they also wanted to look at these reports that they had noticed had been done at other sites by this same agency. And that, interestingly enough, every time the government takes a look at a community that says, hey, so we're sick next to, you know, a nuclear weapons site, they come back and say, it's fine. You're okay. And to see if there was anything to that. And we said, absolutely. We're an open book. Our community's an open book. We welcome a fresh set of eyes.
How did you work with them or advise them or allow yourselves to be interviewed by them over this 2 year period of time, which is massive for any kind of journalistic investigation?
It really was massive. And so how we started is we provided a lot of background. We have a Facebook page that has over 20,000 people on it. We have a YouTube channel. Ever since we were hosting public meetings and attending public meetings back in 2012, we had recorded every single meeting so that we, as people say, have the receipts for what happened in documentation, right? And also so that people that can't make it can see what was discussed. So we gave them access to all of that and said, we're an open book, watch these meetings. And there was a specific meeting that the agencies held when this report was available in 2016.
Meaning the ATSDR report.
That's correct. And then EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, came out and co-hosted a meeting with them to say, it's fine. Go back to living. You guys are worried over nothing. Nothing happened. Nothing bad is happening at the site. And we all left basically just feeling like we'd been gaslit. We knew better. I think I told you this. You know, when people get sick, they want to know why they got sick.
And what were the sicknesses that were showing up in your community that had you and the others so concerned?
So what's interesting is, I mean, we do have a lot of rare cancers, right? A lot of very aggressive cancers in young folks, a lot of cancers that are routinely seen in older white men, like a glioblastoma brain tumor that were showing up in young children that were girls, you know, things like that. But what really struck us is the number of people who were living with a chronic illness, like multiple sclerosis, MS, or lupus, or rheumatoid arthritis, these type 1 diabetes, these autoimmune diseases that destroy your life and can also lead to cancers. And many people had more than one. And whole families were inundated without previous genetic history of having this.
So when the report came out and you were stunned, shocked, appalled, perhaps, by what it said, what was done as follow-up within the community?
The first thing that we did when we left that meeting, feeling very gaslit, very, we felt like we'd been lied to, but we couldn't figure out where. We went and hosted our own public meeting to just get together and talk about it, compare our illnesses and whatnot, and also kind of pick through the report as best we could, right? First of all, this report should never have been written. And that was Reuters, that was their finding as well. This report was premature. There had not been enough testing done at the site to even find out where all the radioactivity was at Westlake. So how can you write a report saying, hey, everything's okay when you don't know where it all is? They had not done enough testing offsite because some of this has left the site. That's been confirmed by the Environmental Protection Agency and offsite testing in the past 4 years. So again, the conclusions that the ATSDR and the EPA used to drop on our community in this report were based on very old data at the site, incomplete data. And also, there were a number of things, air monitors that went down that were faulty and whatnot. We had felt, and you remember this all along for the past 11 years, that this agency didn't do enough, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, had not done enough testing to be able to even know what the heck was going on at the site and what had happened. And so when this Reuters, after, they did their 2-year investigation and they looked at, the report, but they also looked at how much data has come out at Westlake Landfill since this report was written. They looked at the report and saw that it included data that even at the time in 2016 that the report was written, some of this data was 20 years old. Some of it was 30 years old. I mean, it was obsolete. And the conclusion they came to, which was exactly how we felt when we left that meeting in 2016, was that the agency and the government very much wanted to be able to just shut us the heck up and get the groundswell and the activism and the support that was growing in our community. They wanted to throw a very heavy blanket on that and snuff it out. So this is what they did. They wanted to say we were okay. So what they did is they wrote a report that would come to that conclusion. And they used data and other things in that report that in reality doesn't support that conclusion.
Since the Reuters report has come out, and this is less than a week ago that we're talking about it, what has been the response to it in your community and in general in the St. Louis community, which is so impacted by this?
So the response to this report is very interesting. When you gaslight an entire community, when you gaslight a sick community, and then they can actually look at a report and a piece of paper and see exactly how you did that. If you're a government agency and they can actually look at this and say, here's how they did it to you guys. It really creates a massive uproar and it empowers. People leave thinking, okay, so I am not crazy. This is real. And they do get very angry. They feel a lot of different things. They feel lack of trust. But one of the amazing things that you have covered that is happening is this coalition to get the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act passed. So one of the things we have is we have a call to action that's already there, right? We have a path forward through this. I mean, we absolutely need RECA to pass, but these community members feel emboldened and now an extra bit of push now to become more active in that.
RECA being the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which is supposed to compensate people who have been harmed by the radioactivity created by U.S. weapons programs, not only was not extended, but it was allowed to lapse because Speaker of the House Mike Johnson would not bring it to a vote, despite the fact that it looked like the votes were there to pass it, and President Biden said that he would sign it. So there's been major obstruction that has been done to disempower Rika completely. How do you think the response to this report is going to impact the ability to revive and promote this bill to the point where it can be passed?
So one of the things I think, without going into a very deep civics lesson, is that people understand, because of the way this report was done, deliberately to mislead, they understand why it's been so hard to, even in the past 10 years, get RECA expanded. They see a very deliberate attempt by their federal government to, not just in this community that they live in, but in all the other communities, downplay exposures and stifle the truth of the illnesses, the full illness list of illnesses that is caused by exposure, just living in proximity to these sites, not even having to play on them, right? Not even having to walk, just living next to them, walking out down your driveway to get the mail and the wind is blowing and you get a couple part, you know, doing everyday things around your house, outdoors and indoors, that could have led to exposures that now explain these illnesses. So I think what it's doing is people feel even more willing and more empowered to link arms with other communities. You know, this is no longer, well, my poison's worse over here because we had a fire, or my poison's worse here because we actually had a production plan. Now it's like, okay, we were all deliberately sacrificed and we all need to come together because that's what's been missing to get RECA passed.
It's a common strategy for anyone who is opposing ground roots activism on the part of citizens to keep us in our separate silos, to emphasize what's different so that we can fight against each other for a small part of the slice of pie that maybe is out there, as opposed to joining together and saying, no, we want a bigger slice of the pie. We want the whole pie. And it sounds like this is a tremendous motivator for people coming together. How has the media in your area been responding to it?
Ooh, I love this question. The members of the media in our community are righteously teed off right now. They are very angry because they also live here, right? They feel lied to. So when this report came out, the agency handed them the script and the thing and said, okay, go report, everything's fine. They're not scientists. So why would they not trust the federal government and this federal agency? So they took it, used their platform to launch it out, telling us we were okay. And now they're looking back and they can see how they were duped. They don't appreciate it at all. They were used to further harm. These federal agencies used their media platform and their followings to further harm this community. So they're taking it very personally and they are mad.
You brought up a point when we were talking just prior to this interview about the fact that the government can issue reports, but there's no mandate for peer review on what they are reporting. Whereas anything that comes from us, we have to have peer review, it has to go through studies, it has to go, which are all delaying tactics that cost a lot of money that we don't have. What do you think is the need for peer review in government studies? And what do you think has stopped it thus far?
What this investigation shows us as far as peer reviewing go is, first of all, the type of study they did here, right? And tried to lay upon this community to tell them that they were okay when they didn't have the information to say that. It's a template. They use this in other communities. So it's their go-to. They knew to use this because it hadn't been questioned when they'd done it in others like Santa Susana. And what that shows us is, because there is no peer review process, they didn't think anyone would catch it. They actually counted on the template working here at Westlake because it worked in other places. And then they said, well, who's going to know? Who's going to know? We're not going to get caught. So those are the two things that has emboldened these agencies and this agency, ATSDR and EPA, to be able to put these studies out that I think this report is going to put a stop to.
And when you said Santa Susana, you were referring to the Santa Susana Field Lab here in Southern California, only 30 miles away from downtown Los Angeles, which is tremendously contaminated, and I will link to previous nuclear hot seats that explore that in much greater detail. Now that this truth has been exposed, and blessings to Reuters, they are the one news agency I always rely on and I always trust because they know what they're doing and they do the hard footwork to get it done. With this report coming out, how are you planning to use it? What can be done to build upon it? And what would be some next steps that the community can take to get some righteous action to take place on it?
That's a great question. So in the works right now is another trip to Washington, D.C. by all RECA communities. And I can share this with you. There is actually, for our Tularosa Basin Downwinders, Tina Cordova, and some of our indigenous RECA communities, there is a GoFundMe up to help them get back to D.C. But this is where we all have to converge. This report impacts all of us because if you read it, it lists other communities that this has been done in. And I think even to some extent, you know, the Santa Susana and Melissa Bumstead and everyone, you know, I think we need to come together and make our way back to DC because you said something earlier about the government wanting to keep us all in our independent silos. We all of these communities have elected officials, right? And so bringing not just us together, but us pushing our elected officials to come together with us is what creates the numbers that we need to finally expand and extend the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to everyone who should have been in it 20 plus years ago.
When we were talking earlier, you also pointed out that we usually lead those of us who oppose nuclear and want to have action taken by the government, we usually lead by talking about cancer or various cancers. You had a point to make about autoimmune diseases. Let the listeners hear what you have to say on that.
Absolutely. So when I'm talking to my community or even other communities that have been impacted, you know, those rare cancers, it's hard. You may have a rare cancer, right? But you don't know that somebody across town has that. And you don't know that there's two more a couple miles from you. So you don't put together that there's a cluster, right? But one thing that develops in these communities are these autoimmune diseases, these tremendously expensive to treat, absolutely life-altering, and in many cases, life-ending eventually autoimmune diseases. And a lot of times they present before the cancers.
And what would these autoimmune diseases that you're spotlighting be?
Some good examples of ones that we frequently see around all these sites and all these other communities across the nation would be multiple sclerosis, would be lupus, Hashimoto disease, which is an autoimmune disease of the thyroid. You see type 1 diabetes, you see rheumatoid arthritis, many other forms, psoriatic arthritis, different forms of arthritis that emerge in like a skin rash and skin abrasion and buildup. Those are just a few. And we can go down the list of other chronic ones. You see a lot of lung diseases, right? Graves disease is another. You see multiple people around you that have many members in their family and some have multiple, right? They don't just have one. Sjogren disease, which is like a very dryness of the saliva gland in the eyes. These are things that people are presenting with. Start with that and say, how many people do you know have one or more of these? Just in your mind, count in your friend group. If you have to go down your Facebook list, go down your text messages. And it's never failed, Levy. It's never failed. People are like, oh my God. And it's like, okay. Now, in your next conversation with one of those people, ask them to look or bring it up, and it grows. And the next thing you know, you're sitting there and you have an entire street full of illnesses, chronic illnesses. And then at that point, people are like, this is not normal. And then move on to the cancers. Okay, so how about these rare cancers? Who do we know? And go from there.
One of the things I like to do in my speaking engagements is ask by a show of hands, how many people here do not know anyone who either has or had cancer? You don't know anyone in your personal life who has or had cancer. Please raise your hand. I have never had a single hand go up.
That's right.
And cancer used to be a rare disease.
It did. But it's not now, and that's the problem. So when you start with the others, the chronics, that's when the red flag goes off. And then you've got them. People don't realize this. I know so many people, you probably do as well, that have a chronic autoimmune illness that have to rely on biologics. And you know what happens? They end up getting leukemia from the medication and from the years being on the medication that stunts the immune system. This chronic inflammation that exists. The other thing we're finding is that if you know to look for it in your community, you can stop it young. Simple blood tests will tell you inflammation markers, and it will help you actually prevent the development. There is some proactive work we can do, but in the meantime, to your point, yes, most people will raise their hand and they say, well, you know, everybody gets cancer nowadays. They don't consider that to be rare, so that's not the red flag.
What do you think it's going to take to motivate people in these communities and people who are outside of them, but who know people in these communities, into taking action on radiation awareness, toxicity awareness, the need for accurate testing, and the steps that need to be taken to mitigate the problems we already have, as well as stop making new ones?
I love this question because I think the federal government has planted a lie in all of these communities, thinking that it takes hundreds to come together and make phone calls to get action. It doesn't. It takes 20. If you find 20 people, really 15, but if you find 20 people and you say, okay, I need you for the next 2 weeks, twice a day to call this number and tell your story. Same 20 people. That's what it takes to get an office. It does not take the number of people, of concerned individuals that you think it does, to move a wheel, to get it going. And then when you combine that with all the communities that have been impacted and everybody in that community is getting people to do the same, you have got a really great math game going to get federal legislation passed in the Senate or the House.
You also had a really brilliant idea about harnessing the power of the entertainment community. Because certainly here in Los Angeles, the Santa Susana Field Lab with its contaminants are right next to the west side of Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, Brentwood, the richer suburbs that are in that area. And a lot of celebrities and entertainment industry people are there. And there have been multiple stories coming out. It seems like there's a new one every week about either a celebrity who has one of these diseases or celebrities concerned because their children have suddenly shown this quote unquote rare disease. Anytime I hear rare disease, rare cancer, I always think, where's the radiation contamination? With all of these people there, what would be the impact if even a few individuals in the entertainment community stepped forward and assisted in making the concerns be known?
I think that the impact, given the size of the platform that people in the entertainment industry have, if they were to link the possibility of their multiple chronic diseases that they all have within their community together to exposures, I think it would be massive. I think it would really blow the lid off of this. But I think that they don't know. I think that for them, again, we do live in silos, even within our own communities. You know, MS is a rare illness. You have Selma Blair, you have Christina Applegate, you have multiple celebrities that are now coming out. Type 1 diabetes in a child is a rare illness. It is rare. How many? Start looking around you, you know, to these celebrities. That's what I would say. Look around you. How many people do you know have a chronic illness? And put it together. It probably is not as rare as you're thinking.
As you're saying this, I'm wondering what the response would be to an outreach on this topic to any of the entertainment industry unions. The actors union, the equity for stage, directors, producers. These are all agencies that deal with their people, and all of them have some kind of health insurance policy available. That might be a way to approach the people who are in the industry to start putting the pieces together and not going, oh, Colin Farrell's son is completely separate from, say, Kim Kardashian and her family or any of the others. And what you are saying and what I'm hearing and what I'm believing is that they're not, because there's a likelihood there may have been another form of contamination, but that radiological contamination is the one that never gets looked at. So let's see what the pieces are and how they might be put together, and if there might be a bigger picture here to look at.
I would tell Hollywood, and I would tell the celebs to do what we do. Hey, draw a 1 mile radius around your house, or go out further, 3 to 4 miles, look within your celebrity neighbors who you consider to be a neighbor, and just start counting how many people you know have something, have a rare illness in a child, have a rare illness themselves. Look at number of miscarriages. Look at things other than cancer. Look at developmental. How many young children needed first steps, right? Developed a little bit slower and needed some therapy and speech therapy to catch up. Look at these things. Look at the numbers of autism. How many people do you know who have had children that are placed somewhere on the spectrum? Start keeping track of this and just see. It's what we do in other communities. I mean, they may be very rich, but these people have neighbors.
And just because they have money does not make them immune to the consequences of what's been done to the environment, because they breathe the same air, they walk the same ground, they are dealing with the same set of issues. And while they may have resources to be able to address them, that doesn't take away the fact that the core, the key to what is causing the problem is still there. It's not being remediated. And if anything, it's getting worse. And we've been lied to about it.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I do think it's just a matter of time. And yes, I am definitely that person that is a glass is half full. I get that. Not everybody is. But I see the building of the coalition. I've seen just in the past 9 months how it's expanded. I've been to DC over 6 times just in the past 9 months, and I see the change in the staffers and their education level. I get to be on phone calls with staffers, with agencies. I get to see that I no longer need to prompt. Many of these staffers know how to hit right back at these agencies. That is progress. You want to talk about the genie out of the box that's not going back in, right? Like that is what we have to fight back with. And I see that only getting stronger. I also see a presidential election right around the corner, of which Arizona and Nevada, very, very heavily impacted sites from the detonation of Trinity and the testing, but also radioactive waste. Those are swing states. It does not take much to influence the votes in that state to swing one way or the other. And so those are the two states that you can watch that we'll be focusing on.
If people listening to this are anywhere near as outraged as I am about this, let alone you, and would like to take action, be of support, what do you suggest they do?
So right now, I would follow two folks. I mean, I'm going to plug us, Just Moms STL. That's a Facebook page. We have a website, Just Moms STL. You can get on there. We also have Westlake Landfill, which is our site specific, but our organization covers all the regional sites in St. Louis. However, for Out West, the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, that would be Tina Cordova, who's leading that. Jump on that one as well, because we're massively coordinating, right? Because we've been doing it a bit longer. We have a bit more resources and more of a following than some of the newer communities. But they are building their own, which is amazing. And that's what we want them to do. The other team you can follow who has been just tremendous on this issue is the Union of Concerned Scientists. And alongside of them, you know, that's Physicians for Social Responsibility. Those two have really done something amazing, not only advocating on this issue, but they have done so much, Libby, grassroots building and platform sharing. You know, you mentioned, I think it's so critical to know that it's not deliberate, but it's really hard to be a poisoned community and fight with everything you have, but also lend your resources over here and take some from your own to help others. It's hard to do that. So they have been a monumental bridge builder. And then what I can do is I don't have to stop my advocacy. I can go to them and be like, hey, see this report, this, this, this. And then they take it and then they go to that community and help them. Does that make sense?
That is the way networks of support happen. And that's the way genuine change happens.
It really is. And that's what we're seeing, because what happens when a community is given the tools, right? It's not built for them, but they're given the tools and the pathway because other communities have been through it and it's shared and they're helped, is they empower, right? It's like building muscle tone. They get strong as they build. And I'm telling you, I do not see this being put back in the box. It's just not possible. We are going to get RECA extended and expanded. The question is when and how quickly. You know, normal legislation takes an average of 6 years. Look at what this group did in 9 months. And none of that's undone. That's still ongoing. Change is happening and it's happening rapidly.
And I know that however that change comes about, you will be somewhere in the thick of it helping to make it happen.
Well, we're committed. You know, you said something earlier on the phone we were talking that is just heartbreaking, which is we are surrounded by death. We are, and illnesses. But this is the part of that that gives us the hope, right? We see the change, and it all comes down to the fact that all of us are pushing to plant a tree that we will never sit under. And we know that, but somebody will, because we can look back and think, gee, I wish that would have been done for me. There's a really amazing spirit and motivation behind this that all communities have. And you know what the other thing is I think that although we have been poisoned and we have been hurt emotionally and spiritually through this, we heal each other emotionally and spiritually through our activism and our advocacy when we're together. And we always say that. I think DC takes a lot out of us physically when we're there together. You know, it's a lot of walking, it's a lot of work. But we always leave just feeling a little bit more healed, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense to me, because I know how heartened I am when you and I manage to have a conversation, be it for the show or be it outside the show, just to have that energy reflected back and the concerns Yes. reflected back, and understand that I'm not alone, you're not alone, and anyone listening to this, you are not alone either. You're part of something larger than yourself, and you're helping to make it happen.
It is. So I would tell everybody, be angry, be very angry. And you know what, though? Be hopeful, because this investigation, they're never going to be able to get away with this again in another community. And that doesn't excuse what they were able to get away with, but that just means we stopped it. And thank you, Reuters, you stopped it. Another community is not going to get gaslit in the same way. And now we have just ripped entire chapters out of their PR playbook.
And about time, too.
That's right.
Dawn Chapman, it's always a joy and invigorating and educational, but more than that, your spirit speaks volumes about who you are, what you do, what you are helping others to do as well. And for that reason and so many others, you are always welcome to be a guest here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. I love being on your show. I love what your show does to all of us. We talk about you all the time and our favorite episodes. We all just appreciate you so much. Not just your show, but what you do for us behind the scenes.
Thank you. It's my honor to do so. That was Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL. To get in touch with her and the group, you can go to the Just Moms STL page on Facebook or their website, STLRadWasteLegacy.com. I'll have links to both of them up on the website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 686.
Activists, shout out.
The RECA Working Group, Radiation Exposure Compensation Act Working Group, led by Indigenous advocates, is planning an event in late September to hold a week-long Indigenous-led and focused event in Washington, D.C. that would involve chartering buses to bring Indigenous activists from New Mexico to D.C., with a stop in Mike Johnson's district in Louisiana, 2 to 3 days of events at the Capitol, including prayers, singing, dancing, drumming, story sharing and lobby meetings, and significant media approaches. Estimates for what it would take to cover this event range from $60,000 to $80,000. And the people in Pueblo and Navajo nations will be holding food sales, bingo events, and selling t-shirts to raise money. The very definition of a bake sale budget. They've also set up a GoFundMe page that is being administered by the Southwest Research and Information Center under their nonprofit status. And I will include a link to that on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 686. Back from the Brink and Dutton Publishing invites individuals and communities to come together and take part in a national reading and community-based dialogue about Annie Jacobson's book, Nuclear War, A Scenario. Between now and the end of September, groups of people will join together within existing or newly formed book clubs to read Nuclear War, A Scenario, and then schedule an in-person or virtual meeting to talk about it, ask questions, and engage in meaningful, respectful dialogue. There will be an opportunity for book club participants to submit questions to Ms. Jacobson that may be answered by her in a Q&A video. If you want to be part of this discussion, but are not part of an existing book club or don't wish to start your own, please RSVP for a virtual book club discussion on the registration page. We will have the appropriate link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 686. And award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman, my personal eminence agrees when it comes to all things nuclear, has a new article out entitled, "With New York's climate action goals in question, governor's comments on the future role of nuclear power worry environmental activists." The article quotes extensively from Dr. Mark Z. Jacobson, a top energy expert, especially alternative energy expert, about New York Governor Kathy Hochul and two state agencies saying New York won't be able to reach its goal of 70% of electricity generated by renewables by 2030. In this article, Jacobson points out that California has reached 100% wind, water, solar, renewable electricity on its main grid for part of the day for the 100th day this year, and in fact, the 100th day out of the past 144. The article is filled with Carl Grossman's usual pithy and insightful comments and will be available through a link on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 686. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 13, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so easy for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow opt-in box, you really cannot miss it, put in your first name and an email address, and voila! Every week, you will get one email with the link to that week's show and a short description of its contents. That way, you don't ever need to miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat or even hunt around for it. It'll be right there for you. You can help with the show because if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, you can send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. That's where we get many of our most important links to stories. And if you appreciate and rely upon the nuclear information that comes to you through this show, we ask that you go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, because we really need your help. Anything at all, we appreciate you for listening and for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, and anybody whose quotes you use. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that, as Margaret Mead said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. There it is, your nuclear wake-up call comes to you fresh every week. Thanks for being here, thanks for listening, and whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because, hey, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat.
The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.